Chapter 9, The Great Huddle. The ninth higher law is, if nobody pays attention, people stop caring. People have to see the effects of what they do, or they won't care. It doesn't matter if the effects are good or bad. If you go out every day and nobody notices whether your work is good, bad, or indifferent, you'll stop caring. Our great huddles tell people we care. We send the message out every week. We want to know what you're doing. If you want to watch the great game of business in action, come to one of our weekly staff meetings. They start at 9 a.m. every Wednesday. They are usually about 50 managers, supervisors, and other people from around the company in attendance. There's a certain buzz in the air. The sound you hear in a theater before the lights go down and the curtain goes up, or in a ballpark as the pitcher finishes his warm-ups and the leadoff batter steps into the plate. What we are anticipating is the weekly ritual of calculating the score. This is where we learn how we are doing on our bonus goals. We figure it out right there in the conference room. People come to the meeting with the latest numbers from their departments. From every entry in the income statement, someone has a number representing the most accurate, up-to-date assessment his or her team can make as to what the entry will be when the month closes. After a brief introduction by me, or whoever is chairing the meeting in my absence, we go around the room and people announce their numbers while everyone else scribbles them down on the scorekeeping forms. Really, blank income statements. There are oohs and ahs and good-natured digs. We can all see how the reported numbers differ from the ones in the game plan, which are printed on one side of the form, and from those given in the last meeting, which we've written down on the previous week's forms. So every announcement provokes a response. Is purchasing getting a greater deals or what? How did production manage to absorb so much overhead in a week? Where did all those automobile sales suddenly disappear to? Who said we couldn't turn around that warranty problem? There is bravado. There is daring. There is trepidation. Some people are confident, even bold. Others are a little bit nervous. Everybody is on show, and nobody wants to let their colleagues down. People love to be heroes. But to be a hero here, you and your department have to perform. You have to come in with a good number. When we finish, the chief financial officer announces the tally, our income or losses, before taxes for the month, assuming these numbers hold up. Then we move on to other news. What's going on here? The Wednesday meeting is the focal point for everything we do at SRC. It is where all the numbers we generate come together, where they get added and subtracted, totaled up, and sent out so they can be used by people in the company to do their jobs. It provides each of us with the information we need to play our position in the great game of business. That's why we sometimes refer to it as the great huddle. When we come out of the meeting, we can see the whole field before us. We know who is where and how the game is unfolding, and what each of us has to do to make sure we keep moving closer to the goal line. As with any meeting, however, the real payoff comes from what happens before and after the huddle. The meetings are, in fact, just one link in a chain of communication that is constantly moving information up and down the organization. From the huddle, the numbers flow back to the rest of the company in a series of follow-up sessions held over the next couple of days. Within 36 hours, virtually everybody in the company has the latest information about where we stand and what we have to do to improve the score, and people are using that knowledge in their individual jobs. They, too, can see the whole field. They are linked to the big picture. They know what it will take to earn a bonus, protect their jobs, increase the value of their stock, generate wealth. How they do is up to them. One way or another, they are moving in the direction and in the same direction. We are all working together to make these fractional improvements that determine whether or not we succeed as a business. This is the great game of business. This is how we play it week in and week out. This is where we put into operation all the principles of open book management, where we apply all the lessons we have learned in previous years, where we use all the tools we've developed and the standards, the game plan, the goals, the payout levels, the different ways of winning. This is how we constantly regenerate the pride and the sense of ownership, how we create mutual trust and respect, build credibility, light the fire in people's eyes. Above all, this is how we drive ignorance in the workplace, teach people how to make money, show them why that's important. And we go from one huddle to the next and see the numbers change and hear the stories behind them. We are learning about business and life and the pot at the end of the rainbow. Not just the people on the shop floor either. All of us are learning all the time. And we're also having fun. There is action. There's drama. There's excitement. There is the thrill of a good game. None of that would have happened without our weekly huddles. They are the means by which we stay connected to one another. They set the pace and the tone and the mood of the entire company. When I see what our huddles do for us, it amazes me that so many companies get by without having regular staff meetings at all. Communicating is one of the most difficult challenges in any business because people hear what they want to hear. If they don't hear anything, they speculate. They read the tea leaves. They start rumors, often unintentionally. Show me a company without regular staff meetings, and I'll show you a company with a rumor mill, not to mention a host of other problems. Rumor mills cost money, lots of money. They are the most expensive form of corporate communication around. They breed fear, mistrust, divisiveness, unrealistic expectations, and ignorance. They take all the problems a company has and make them worse. For that, you pay through the nose. There's a major problem with most staff meetings. The boss is the only one communicating. Those meetings waste everybody's time, including yours if you're the boss. For openers, you're not getting the information you need to be a good leader. You sure aren't getting help from your staff. You're not getting your messages across. Every one of them is being interpreted and distorted in ways you would never suspect. The main message you send has nothing to do with what you say. It comes from your actions. When you dominate staff meetings, you are telling people you don't value their contributions. You don't think they make a difference. That's probably not the message you intend to deliver. You may not even believe it, but it's what they hear. On the other hand, it's not enough to get the attendees to contribute or even to have good meetings per se. You may have great staff meetings with your managers, but if you don't bring the rest of the organization into the loop, you will lose a lot of the benefits. People will feel excluded, maybe even resentful. Instead of teamwork, you will get ignorance and suspicion. The barriers will go up. Bear in mind that I'm talking about the regular staff meetings that companies use for internal communication. Every company, including ours, will have all kinds of other meetings, and some of them won't be or shouldn't be open, participatory, or part of a process involving anyone except the participants. But the regular staff meeting belongs in a category by itself because it plays a special role, or at least it ought to. Its most important function is to build the organization. It should be drawing the company together. It should be helping to educate people about the business. It should be providing managers with the tools they need to manage and frontline employees with the tools they need to do their jobs. It should be sending clear, unambiguous messages. It should be encouraging communication at every level. It should be unifying people around common values and goals. We get all that from our huddles. The entire company depends on them and looks forward to them. They have become so popular, in fact, that we keep outgrowing the rooms where we hold them. When we tried having them every other week for a while, there was a big outcry, and we quickly switched back. It's not just that the meetings themselves are good, although we do try to make them as interesting, as exciting, and as efficient as possible. The real test of a staff meeting is its value to the people who aren't there. They too should be participants. They should know that they have a direct effect on what happens at the meeting, and that what happens at the meeting will have a direct effect on them. Our people know that because of the system we have developed for keeping them informed and involved. To some extent, that system reflects our particular experiences and idiosyncrasies as a business. But the principles are universal, and the basic elements, the steps of the process, can be adapted to any company in any industry. The best place to start is with the game. Games are built around cycles, or rather cycles within cycles. In Major League Baseball, for example, there is a cycle every inning. You repeat the inning cycle 9 times per game, and then repeat the game cycle 162 times per season, at which point you can think about starting another season cycle next year. In football, it's 4 downs per possession, 4 quarters per game, 16 games per season. Every competitive sport follows the same basic pattern. The great game of business is also built around cycles. The way we play it, there's a cycle every week, every month, every quarter, and every year. We tend to think of each weekly cycle as a separate game, consisting of 4 distinct stages: the great huddle, post-huddle chalk talks, execution, and the pre-huddle. The great huddle is the first stage of the game. The second stage comes on Wednesday afternoon and Thursday, when the people in the huddle return to their departments and go over the numbers with other members of their respective teams, who fill out scorecards of their own. These follow-up meetings are more like post-huddle coaching sessions or chalk talks than huddles. In each one, the group leader is analyzing the numbers, telling the stories behind them, passing along other news from around the company, discussing what plays the team should be running in light of the latest score. In the third stage of the game, the players go back on the field and run the plays they've discussed. They execute. What they are doing is applying the information from the huddle to the nitty-gritty circumstances of their job. Maybe cash is tight, so they cut back on expenses and are more careful with supplies. Maybe they have to absorb more overhead to get into the next payout level on the profit goal. So they put off their housekeeping or administration goals and focus on production. Whatever the situation, they do what they can to improve the score using the standards as a guideline. Meanwhile, the coaches are out there motivating and facilitating, making sure the players know where they are going and have what they need to do their job. The fourth stage begins shortly before the next great huddle. By then, the score has changed, but the changes may not be readily apparent, and managers need to study and identify them. They need to do the scoring. They do this in the pre-huddle. What each team does will send ripples through the company, affecting every other team's results. When the production people cut back on supplies and expenses, for example, the benefits show up in the numbers reported by engineering. So it's time to regroup. Now the information flows the other way from the frontline workers and supervisors to the managers who report the numbers in the huddle. On Tuesday afternoon and early Wednesday morning, there's another series of meetings, sort of pre-huddle huddles, at which the managers of a department get together and revise their estimates from the previous week. They go over all the entries in the income statement for which they are responsible and decide what they now think each one will be when the month closes. At 9 a.m. on Wednesday, they are back in the conference room, ready to recalculate the score and start another game. That is the basic cycle we use in playing the great game of business. It sounds time-consuming, but in fact, no one spends more than 4 hours in the various meetings per week, and 95% of our people attend only one meeting that lasts an hour or less. We go through this cycle 4 or 5 times per month, depending on the number of weeks. After the month closes, the accounting department pulls together the actual numbers and distributes the monthly financial statements. From that, we can see how close each of us came on our final estimates and how the various teams perform. Meanwhile, we have already begun the next monthly cycle. Of course, any game is more fun if the stakes keep rising as you go along. That happens from week to week as we get closer to the end of the month. It also happens from month to month, thanks to the bonus program. Since the payoffs are made quarterly, we can fall short in the first 2 months and still make it up in the third. Alternatively, if we have a great first month of the quarter, there's a lot of pressure not to let the bonus slip away. So we not only have a game a week and a game a month, but we also have a game a quarter, with each succeeding month a little more exciting than the one before. And there's more. Remember, we've designed the bonus program so that we're going after the biggest percentage of the total annual bonus in each succeeding quarter. And we always have a shot at any portion of the bonus we've missed in the previous quarter. As a result, the stakes keep rising from quarter to quarter. The excitement continues to build, and everybody stays involved right up to the end of the year. That gives us an annual game plan as well. What makes it all possible is the communication system centered around the weekly meetings. That system ensures that all of us are always up to date on all the latest scores in all the games. We are following the action. When everybody follows the action, everybody is ready to play. Tips for having truly great huddles and getting the most out of them. If you want to play the game the way we do, you clearly need some sort of a system like this one to draw people into the action. That doesn't mean you need one just like ours. On the contrary, your system will inevitably look, sound, and feel very different, as well it should. Companies are as diverse as people, and nothing is more distinctive than the way you communicate. You have to develop a language and a style with which you and your people feel comfortable with, that fits your personality as a business. You will also have to adapt other companies' techniques to your circumstances. and you may well have to invent new techniques of your own. The truth is that every business is going to face unique challenges in developing an effective communications process. If you need help in overcoming them, my advice is that you begin by explaining the problem to your people and asking them for their ideas. Beyond that, let me offer you some lessons that we have learned over the years and that you may find useful as well. Keep it regular and on time. The most important thing about our weekly meetings is that everybody knows it begins at 9 o'clock every Wednesday morning. It's not 10:30 on Tuesday this week, 3 o'clock on Wednesday next week, then back to 9 after that. It's always same day, same time, same place. That way people can count on it. They can plan on it. They can develop a routine around it. They don't have to spend a moment thinking about where and when the meeting is going to take place. They can focus all their attention on the game. Hold it frequently enough to stay in control of the numbers. I always talk about our weekly meetings, but for a while, we went to one meeting every 2 weeks. We changed because I thought people were bored. When we got to the part of the meeting where we would exchange news, most people had nothing to offer. That made me mad. I thought they weren't trying. They didn't care. On the other hand, it occurred to me that maybe we were trying too hard. Maybe we needed a break. Finally, I said, what the hell? Let's go to bi-weekly meetings. It was a disaster. Nobody was happy, which was surprising. You'd think people would prefer to have fewer meetings, but they were more interested in knowing the score. The change totally disrupted our routines. People lost track of what was going on, what they had to do to achieve the goals. 2 weeks was just too long to go without a meeting. We didn't know where we were from one meeting to the next. In some categories, the estimates in the meeting turned out to be off by as much as 30 to 40%. The actual numbers in the month-end statements. I could see the walls going up between departments. People started blaming one another for their problems. The chatter stopped. It was like withdrawal. We were really shaking, so we switched back. I'm not saying you shouldn't have biweekly staff meetings. Other companies may find them just right, but for us it was a big mistake. The lesson, develop a routine that lets you control the numbers and then stick with it. Put a name and a face on every line in the income statement. A major benefit of the huddle is that it humanizes the business. It gets rid of the invisible enemy, the they, as in they screwed up, or they're out to get us, or they don't know what they're doing. The invisible enemy destroys company after company. It sows suspicion and ignorance and divisiveness. You have to hunt it down and eliminate it before it eliminates you. We go after it every chance we get. One way we fight the invisible enemy is to divide up responsibilities for the financials, to attach real people to every number and every line. We go around the room on Wednesday morning. The numbers aren't coming from them. We are hearing directly from Pam in scheduling, Jeff in sales, and Irene in production. So we don't respond as if we were just getting numbers, say, from accounting. When they have bad news, we get angry. When Irene has bad news, we ask if she needs help. There's a personal connection. We want to support each other. When one person is down, someone else steps in and picks him or her up. To establish those connections, you have to personalize the income statement. That means going through the process I described earlier. Break down the major categories on the income statement into controllable elements, and then assign each element to someone in the company. That person will then be responsible for reporting the number in the meeting. In most cases, he or she will be the manager whose team has the greatest impact on the number. If most of your people work in production, have a representative from that department that reports labor costs. If most of them are involved in selling, give the responsibility to someone from sales. The whole idea is to match the numbers with the people who have the greatest control over them and to spread the reporting responsibilities as widely as possible. Be sure to include representatives from every area of the business. Invite anyone was something to contribute. Our weekly staff meetings are open to everyone in the company, but the people who show up usually have a specific reason for being there. They have a number to report or a piece of news to deliver, or it's important for them to see what's happening. Most of the participants are middle or top managers with departmental responsibilities. On the other hand, we don't want to be exclusive. There should not be any mystery about the meeting. It should be a familiar part of the landscape. So we make a point of inviting a lot of people in the course of a year. Occasionally, they wish they hadn't. From time to time, the manager will bring a frontline supervisor into the meeting, say the head of the cylinder head department. Whenever we see that, we know there's a bad number to report, and the manager has decided to let the person responsible come in and explain it. It creates a little incentive not to have a bad number again. Have a fixed format, but don't be boring. Our meetings generally last about an hour and a half, during which we cover an enormous amount of territory and still manage to keep people on the edge of their seats. We do it by having a simple format that never varies, while making sure that the content is interesting and that the pace is fast. I usually start the meeting with a few brief comments designed to set the tone and establish a theme. More about that later. Then we go around the room twice. The first time we do the income statement in the manner I described before. That's always interesting, provided you know what's going on and all the participants do. Outsiders, on the other hand, tell me we go too fast for them to follow the action. When we finish, we know how we are doing on our pre-tax profit goal. Then we do another circuit during which people report any news or other information they feel the group would want to hear. New customers, important milestones, industry awards, fishing results, golf results, individual accomplishments, whatever. This part is the flavor of a town meeting, with each member getting up to tell us a little bit about what's happening in his or her neighborhood. There is much joking, congratulating, and laughing. We are renewing the bonds of our community. After we finish the second pass, I close the meeting with a summary of the results. Often I will come back to the theme I talked about at the start of the meeting, or I may pick up something one of the other participants has said. My purpose is simply to highlight whatever I think our common focus should be, based on what we've just heard and what is going on around us, the environment in which we are operating. Then we adjourn. Be a leader, not a boss. If you're running the meeting, be careful to avoid the trap of being the person with all the answers. I never want people to think they're reporting to me so that I can tell them what to do. What's important is for me to keep putting back in their hands the responsibility and the tools for earning more. It's easy for me to come in after the fact and say, you should have done this or that. But if I do, they'll start leaving the decisions up to me. So I refrain from that type of backward criticism. Instead, I keep looking forward, and I encourage them to do the same. I want people to be ahead of me, to drive as far ahead of me as they can. I need tools to help them do that, just as they need tools. We are all using the same tools, the financial statements, so we're all moving in the same direction. We're a big team of horses pulling a wagon all in step. There aren't any more mixed messages, just the results on the financials. After my opening remarks, I let other people do most of the talking until the end. Mainly, I want to keep things moving. When people report especially good numbers, I cheer along with everyone else. When a bad number is bad, we stop and get an explanation. Good or bad, we want to hear the stories behind the numbers. By the time we finish, certain themes have emerged. We can see where we're weak and where we're strong, what we've done well, and what we must improve to hit our targets. I talk about these themes in my summary. They're the messages contained in the numbers, the ones we need to emphasize when we take the results back to the rest of the company. Make sure the numbers get out. Never forget what happens after the huddle is more important than what happens in it. The whole exercise is a big waste of time if the information stays with the people in the room. That's why we put so much emphasis on the chalk talks. We hold as many as necessary to get the word out as fast as possible. In a small department, there may be only one chalk talk. In a large department, there may be as many as eight. The head of production, for example, meets with all seven of the frontline supervisors on the shop floor. Then they go back and hold similar sessions with their respective teams. In each meeting, people are not only getting the numbers and the news, they are also figuring out what they can do to improve the score. This is a vital part of the process. There is no education and no improvement without it. Make sure it happens. We have one factory where it didn't happen for a long time. The plant manager lied to us. When we found out, we fired him. But the experience taught us a lesson. Now we run spot audits throughout the company once a week to make sure that everybody has been brought up to date. Insist that people write it down. At first, we thought it was enough to tell people the latest financial results on a weekly basis. We did a lot of talking, explaining, and coaching, but that was about it. Then we discovered one of our factories hadn't been playing the game at all, and I began to have nightmares. I worried that we were victims of our own PR. that we were really weren't teaching people to understand the financial statements. We just thought we were because so much had been written about it. We talked it over and decided to start distributing blank scorecards to everybody in the company. Not only would people hear the numbers, they would write the numbers down. This is actually an important step in the whole educational process, one we should have taken on early. When you report to people every week about the condition of the company, you establish credibility. When you get them to write the information down, you teach. Education comes by repetition. It's like learning the multiplication tables. If you do it often enough, it becomes second nature. That's what we want. We want to be sure that we are really teaching people what they need to know, that we are taking ignorance out of the workplace, that we are educating people to understand what needs to be done. The weekly scorecard. In the early years after the buyout, we did the projected monthly income statement on a blackboard in our conference room. I'd stand by the board and write down the numbers as people gave them to me. Then we total them up and see how well we're doing on a pre-tax profit goal. We still take the same basic approach, but now we have printed scorecards which we modify from time to time as the company changes and as we get ideas for improvements. In the print version of the book, you can see an example of our scorecard, including elements such as plan, sales, standard cost, gross standard income, inventory receipts. Inventory is a balance sheet item, but we note it here particularly because we want to keep an eye on it. Also because we need to do it in our cash flow statement later on in the meeting. The manufacturing variances are posted, contribution margin, expenses, operating income, non-operating expenses, income from operations, the income or loss before taxes, the profit percent per month, and the profit that's been accumulated for the year. How to lead with an open book. At the beginning of May 1991, I faced a perplexing problem. The economy was in a recession, but we had just finished the strongest first quarter in our history. The trouble was that we had left a lot of money on the table, and we were heading into a period that looked as though it was going to be very tough. As we sat down for our weekly staff meeting, I had to decide what sort of message I wanted to send out to the organization. Did I want to praise the people for a great quarter? Cajole them for letting opportunities get away? Warn them about dark clouds on the horizon? It was, I admit, the kind of problem most CEOs would love to have. In the end, I did what I usually do. I let the numbers do the talking, and people got the message loud and clear. There's a natural tendency to talk about a system like ours as a boon to the people on the shop floor, a way to make their lives more meaningful and rewarding, to give them hope for the future. I think that's all very true, but those of us who run open book companies have a little secret. The biggest beneficiary may well be the person at the top. Know when to push, when to hug, when to cheer, when to boo, and when to kick people in the butt. The numbers tell you what's really going on in the organization. A CEO's job is to be on top of the organization's numbers. Our system makes that job very easy. People produce the numbers on a daily basis. I can get them instantaneously. And they're good numbers, real numbers. We can give them right to our lenders. We're so current with our numbers, outsiders are shocked. In most businesses, it takes weeks to come up with numbers like ours. And even then, they aren't as accurate because they aren't being collected by the people who do the work. They are being put together by the accounting department, and there are no checks to make sure the numbers reflect reality. So I can use those numbers to guide me. I can see trends emerging before they become crises. That allows me to take action while things are still going well. I don't mean to tell people what to do. I mean to point out to them that a problem could be developing, giving them the opportunity to head it off. The financials give you a different perspective on problems. They allow you to let them develop or even worsen in order to get a thorough sense of what's going wrong. It doesn't bother me to see that we have problems. The important thing is whether or not people are working toward solutions. We are always going to have problems. The question is, what are we going to do to fix the problems? The numbers give me perspective. They tell me what's really important and what isn't. Missing a target for 1 month isn't important. Missing it for 3 months running is important. The numbers also provide me with the security I need to let people take risks. They show me how far I can let people go before I have to step in and pull them back. That's very important. If you want people to grow, you have to let them take risks and you have to let them fail. The tricky part is knowing how much to let people fail, where to draw the line. The numbers are my guide. to tell me when one person's failure or a department's failure is endangering others. The numbers protect me from paranoia. When you're the head of a company, paranoia is an occupational hazard. You hear all the problems and the complaints, all the criticism. You see people being disloyal. You may find out that some of them are stealing. Under the circumstances, it's not unusual for the boss to become paranoid, and that paranoia can undermine a business. The boss thinks he or she is going to get ripped off if they're not careful, which may happen. What he or she doesn't see is that he or she is painting themselves into a corner with a sign that says, "Protect yourself from getting screwed." Some people will protect themselves to the point of not being able to win, not being able to grow, not being able to profit. They just can't stand the idea of getting screwed, so they set up a lot of barriers. When you knock down the barriers, you find that most people weren't out to screw you in the first place. You've designed a system to protect you from the 10 or 20% of the population with bad intentions, and you've discounted the 80 to 90% with good intentions. This happens all the time. We constantly set up rules for the people who break them. In the process, we penalize the contributors. I happen to think that's not fair. I know that it's a big mistake. If we had run SRC that way, we would never have been able to take $100,000 in equity in 1983 and turn it into $20 million in 1991.